Unstoppable Sound Agency. Welcome to this edition of Move to Amend Reports, where we connect you with activists and organizers working on the front lines of the democracy movement to bring you the lowdown on corporate rule, corporate personhood, and money as speech. This is the space to find the info you need to help pass the We the People Amendment and legalize democracy. Tonight, our executive producer, Keon Bliss, is wearing three hats, a producer hat, a co-host hat, and a guest hat. So we're welcome to the mic, Keon, as you're always with us on Move to Amend Reports.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Laura. It's great to be here. How are you doing?
Well, I was all excited because I was pretty sure I was going to have a white Christmas, but now it's like 45 degrees and raining out. So my Utah mountain home might actually not have a white Christmas this year, but I guess I can live through that.
I feel you on that. I'll be traveling to Indiana here on 22nd to go visit some friends and family out there. So I may actually get to enjoy a white Christmas the first time in 2 years. Being in California right now, it's also raining, and it's not too cold at all. It drops to maybe the low 40s, high 30s, but usually gets up in the highs of the high 50s and low 60s out here.
That's downright balmy compared to the temperatures we're having. I personally don't mind the rain, but this is not good for the ski industry. It's raining, you know, at the base of the resorts in Big Cottonwood Canyon and Little Cottonwood. Here's your ski report, skiers. So it's raining. After they've been making snow now for about 6 to 8 weeks, it's raining on it. And it's so anyway. It'll be snow soon enough, I'm sure. And interestingly enough that we're getting this rain and that's water. And tonight's show is all about water and the water protectors at Standing Rock. In the first segment, we have Move to Amend's communications coordinator, Keon Bliss, discussing his recent journey to the Ashadi Sakon camp at Standing Rock, where he delivered supplies and connected with folks there. Joining him later is Eric Rydberg, who will shed light on resistance as one of the many water protectors victimized by state violence. But first, we're going to spend a few minutes with Keon, Move to Amend Reports executive producer, who spent several days over Thanksgiving at Standing Rock in the Ashadi Sakon camp.
Thanks, Laura. As you know, many of our listeners are probably aware, Move to Amend stands in solidarity with the Standing Rock water protectors against the Dakota Access Pipeline. In November, our national team started a crowd fundraiser that raised nearly $2,000 to purchase 4 winterized tents and other supplies, which were delivered to Ashadi Sakon. During that time, I actually traveled from Northern California with Move to Amend national staff member Millicent Millie Harmon and Humboldt County Move to Amend affiliate coordinator Kelsey Reedy, alongside a group of Humboldt State University students, in order to deliver and help set up some winterized tents and supplies that were donated to help the people fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline. It was a very long drive. It took us about 3 days to actually get to North Dakota and get into camp, but we managed to arrive at camp with the assistance from fellow travelers from Northern California, a woman and her daughter from the Hoopa Nation that lives out in Humboldt County. They helped guide us as a caravan to camp and helped us get situated. And once we were there, we helped set up tents and bought some building materials so that we could create baseboards that could go under the tents in order to keep them off the ground, because the land around the Cannonball River actually gets very muddy whenever it rains or snows. I want to give a big shout out to Millie and Kelsey for their tremendous work helping to shuttle supplies in and out of camp, helping the kitchen, and leading the charge in building the tents and materials and getting our group there back safely.
So as I understand it, there's like there are myriad camps set up around. So there's the one big Oshetisekwan camp, but in mm-hmm. that camp, there's a lot of little camps. And so yours was the California, not necessarily little, but because the big camp is really big.
Yes, indeed. The camp is basically.
How many people were there?
Oh, there were thousands of people there when we arrived. But by the time we had left after Thanksgiving, which is considered a day of mourning for the First Nations, for those who don't know, there were hundreds more people arriving, and we were being told there were up to 10,000 people among all the camps. There are multiple larger camps split along both sides of the Cannonball River. The camp of the Sacred Stones, located in the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, and the Oshetisekwan camp on the north side of the Cannonball River, which is where we stayed. There are smaller camps within each of these, run by different indigenous communities and other groups, such as the Red Warrior Camp and the California Kitchen Camp, which is where we were welcomed to sleep at. While these camps are not officially affiliated with the Sacred Stone Camp and the Standing Rock Sioux, they all share the common goal of protecting the water from the Dakota Access Pipeline. While the majority of camps were led by the various indigenous tribes within the coalition, the California Kitchen Camp being run by Northern California indigenous people, many of the people at camp were non-indigenous and white. There were people from across the U.S. and from around the world, from places as from Canada to Nicaragua and even Greece. There were former military veterans, social justice and political organizations, and independent travelers just looking for their next experience or just to help out. It was a unique culture and a spirit at camp, but it also could lead to conflicts and clashes between those cultures. I heard of several incidents and saw one where non-Indigenous people were causing a ruckus at camp from just disrespecting the elders during ceremonies to even driving drunk through camp, which, for those of you who don't know, alcohol and drugs are explicitly prohibited from camp. Even more concerning were the instances of infiltration by the forces defending the pipeline, where people serving the private security firms hired by Energy Transfer partners or off-duty North Dakota police officers were actually sent into camp to either spy on the action planning meetings, spread rumors that create discord among the people there, or just incite violence during peaceful ceremonies and even threatening others with violence. Anything to give the police an excuse to raid the camp. And I want to emphasize and make clear for anyone who supports Standing Rock or intends to travel there to help. Standing Rock is not U.S. territory. It is a sovereign nation with its own customs and rules which require our respect. If you're in going there, we did not simply go to take an experience from being there or to do whatever we wanted. We went there to offer ourselves as resources to support the camp however it was needed, whether that is building tents, gathering and chopping firewood, helping make meals, or clean up in the kitchens. We did whatever was asked of us. So if you're planning to travel to camp, I would ask everyone, please leave your privileges and your sense of entitlement behind. They are calling the shots. We are not.
Past news stories have said that the original route of the Dakota Access Pipeline went just north of Bismarck, North Dakota, but was moved due to concerns about contaminating water supplies. What does that say to you about how either the corporation in charge of construction and or the U.S. government values the lives and livelihoods of Native people as opposed to others?
You know, Laura, to me, it speaks volumes to the depth of indifference and racism towards the original inhabitants of the land that were settled and occupied by we the people of the United States. The population of Bismarck is about 90% white, and the local governments knew the risks from an inevitable pipeline spill and rightly rejected it. So this to me is what modern colonialism looks like in 2016. Rather than put a white community at risk for a business venture from which they are the primary beneficiaries, the corporation building the pipeline chose to reroute it through indigenous land and force the Lakota and Dakota peoples to accept the risk on their behalf at the barrel of a gun.
So yeah, I want to butt in here for a second before you finish your thought, because you know, there was a news report last week or earlier this week that there was a pipeline spill just 2.5 hours from Standing Rock. And that was on December 13th. And 170,000 gallons of crude oil poured into a tributary of the Little Missouri River, which, of course, we know dumps into the Big Missouri. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so this whole idea of what was going on at Bismarck and the people there being afraid of a spill, and what's going on in Standing Rock and the people there being afraid of a spill, you know, both are very legitimate gripes.
Yes, exactly right. This is exactly what the Lakota and Dakota peoples are worried about. And their fears came true with a different pipeline just 150 miles away. This is the violence of white settler colonialism that continues well into this day. If you look at the history of the United States objectively, and that does not include the victor's version typically taught within U.S. public education, it is a long and bloody history of European settlers coming to a new continent, claiming and colonizing the land as their own, and then forcibly annihilating the original inhabitants and their cultures when they rightly resisted. And in 2016, the Dakota Access Pipeline is just the latest chapter in that ongoing push to steal land and destroy the people and cultures who live on it. As U.S. citizens, we are all the beneficiaries from this colonialism, and it is our responsibility to acknowledge and dismantle the systems which allow it to continue. And I really want to emphasize this point because it's important for our listeners to know and understand. This is not just another protest or action. This is a resistance movement being led by the largest coalition of indigenous First Nations in modern history, maybe ever. This is a real struggle for survival, to protect a major water source for millions of people. And many of them, most of them even, are non-indigenous. And they're not going away until the pipeline, which the water protectors refer to as the Black Snake, is dead or they are removed by violent force, which North Dakota police and private security for DAPL have openly demonstrated since April and are more than willing to do.
Thanks, Keon. Coming up next, we'll be featuring a conversation about the nature of settler colonialism being waged against the Standing Rock Sioux and other First Nations, and the need for decolonization that guarantees sovereignty and rights for Indigenous people. We'll get the ball rolling after a quick public service announcement.
To learn more about corporate personhood, money as protected political speech, and how to get involved with Move to Amend, visit movetoamend.org. Don't forget to sign the petition and join over 400,000 people supporting the We the People Amendment at movetoamend.org/motion. You can also text the word sign to 707-656-4019.
You are listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we bring you the voices from the movement to amend the Constitution and abolish corporate rule. This next conversation is a recorded interview I took with a woman I met as she facilitated a group discussion about decolonization in one of the larger community tents at Ocheti Sekoan. Her name is Ketsala Carson, who will use her own words to introduce herself and her people.
Basala relations. I am from Manahuac, Nicaragua territory. That's my motherland. I am Quexala, I'm Mestiza, and I usually live in a Miskwichiwas Galigan or Beaver Hills House, or what's called now Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, which is the motherland of the Blackfoot, Cree, Nakota, Soto, and Métis Nation. And I am grateful to be here on Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota motherland. Yeah, so that's about me.
When you're living in Ocheti Sekoan, finding a quiet place can be quite difficult. Fortunately, Ketsala was kind enough to meet me in the early morning hours when it was most quiet. I started our conversation with a question about the role of corporations in the history of violence from settler colonialism, which continues with the Dakota Access Pipeline.
As for the questions that you asked about how corporations fit into colonialism, like corporations are colonialism. There's like the idea that like that corporations are taking over sacred lands or lands that are protected. All lands are sacred and all lands are protected, and everything that corporations are doing on these lands is colonial violence. We talk a lot in the class that I do at Edochitisha going about how colonial violence is entitlement. And the idea of entitlement, that we can go anywhere we want, we can roam anywhere we want, we can do whatever we want with the land without having to have a reciprocal relationship with it, or without having to give back to it, or without leaving it in a better way than we found it for future generations, is colonial violence. And for me, decolonization, the simplest way that I can put it, is the repatriation of land and law to the original inhabitants of that area. So the way that plays out, like, we can decolonize education and we can decolonize our movements, but unless our movements are aimed towards the repatriation of land and law, then that's not decolonization. And we can decentralize whiteness and we can decentralize white dominance and all of that terrorism that is brought in, but unless we are centralizing indigenous peoples and indigenous voices and indigenous governance, which continues to exist since time immemorial, we're not decolonizing anything, really. Yeah, I think that that's like the important aspect for other movements to bring into what they're doing, because we have a lot of calls like decentralizing white dominance is not like decolonization, and in a lot of movement that's how it gets appropriated. So we change our classrooms, we change our teaching styles, we do all of these things that are amazing and that go towards decolonization, but the world as we know it now, like, does not exist consensually. For us, like, the federal government actually doesn't have a right to exist by its own jurisdiction and by its own laws, because it was taken over by treaty, but like the treaty has not been fulfilled, and like the treaty is what allowed the expansion of settlers. And so because treaty promises haven't been kept, and because that treaty relationship of nation to nation has not been respected, the federal government like actually has no jurisdiction over those lands. But what the federal government has done is put the onus on indigenous people to prove that the federal government has no right to exist. And there's been several court cases that have existed and that have gone down in the past, and they've all been overturned or they've been appealed or dismissed even. And we see like the corruption in our justice system, that even by their own laws and when we play by their game.
For people historically raised to believe we have a divine mandate that entitles us to the land we call home, the topic of decolonization may be hard for some of us to hear. But it is a stark truth that requires our attention. The land of the United States was acquired through the violent theft and attempted genocide of its original inhabitants, and that legacy continues on within every facet of U.S. culture that we inherited. From the Union Pacific Railroad Company to energy transfer partners, powerful corporations have played an integral part in the colonization and violence against indigenous people. As we at Move to Amend continue to build the multi-ethnic intergenerational movement to dismantle the system of corporate rule, I asked Kitsala how we non-Indigenous supporters could build trust and organize in solidarity with Indigenous people.
There's a huge mythification that Indigenous people only exist on reserves, mm-hmm. and only exist like in rural areas far away from cities, and that's what Indigenous people are, and they get dehumanized into the other. But there's so many Indigenous folks in urban areas, and I imagine that you organize in a lot of urban areas.
Yes.
And kind of like finding those relationships. I know in Canada we have like the Friendship Center, and I know they exist in the United States too. And those are spaces that exist to create relationships in between Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities. As like as an Indigenous studies academic, that's another like huge community to tap into. And like we exist for that. Mm-hmm. We exist to be the translation in between both of these communities. And there's Indigenous folks and settler folks who are part of doing this important work. And those are the teachers. Something that I've like recognized here more than anywhere else is that the entitlement to learn is colonial violence. So the entitlement to resourceify Indigenous people for the betterment of settler lives and for the betterment of, or for settler well-being or settler movements, is a co-optation and is a dehumanization of those Indigenous peoples. So I think building reciprocal relationships when and where is possible and appropriate. So not going to a First Nation, not going to chief and council and saying, hey, like, we want to do this, but like, I don't know. I have an example where this this Rotaract group came to me, and they were like, "We want to do a Bannock sale." And Bannock is like a Scottish Irish bread that was brought over with the fur trade, but it's like really ingrained in Indigenous communities because it's existed here for so long. And so they wanted to do a Bannock sale for the unpotable water on reserves, and I was like, what is this? And so I showed up to their meeting and just was like, this is so inappropriate. Like, it's inappropriate, like, because I was like, what do you want to do? And they wanted to do an awareness run, and they wanted to do a Bannock fundraiser, and then somehow give those funds of the Bannock fundraiser to a maintenance fund for a reserve. They had no reserve in mind. Like, not all reserves don't have potable water. Like, they just, this ridiculous white savior stuff. And so in my conversation with them, I just was like, you need to build these relationships. You cannot provide solutions to the problems that you don't understand. And the problems of Indigenous people are not for you to solve. People have lived with these problems for generations, and they know what the solutions are, but because resources are taken away from them, because they are disempowered by the society and the structures that we live in, they are not able to create those solutions to those problems. So first of all, like, going in and recognizing that Indigenous people have the solutions to their own problems, and it's about destroying the structures that disempower them every day. Finding folks to make relationships with who are willing to teach, and who have the energy and who have the calling to do that, because not all Indigenous people are here to do that. We're not all here to educate about what decolonization is. We're not all here to relive our trauma constantly so that white folks and settler folks can understand what it's like to be an Indigenous person and what that experience is like. Other things I can think of is just read. There's so much. There's folks who write about their everyday experience as Indigenous people in this, like, colonized modern world. There's folks who write about what our traditions and our governance were like back in the day. There's folks who write about how our traditions and our governances have continued to exist now to the present and how they function. There's folks who write about all this stuff, and that information is there, and it's made accessible for so that people don't go into communities and feel entitled to, like, to have all of the labor and all of the energy of that community be focused on them. Yeah, that being said, like, I don't know how the local communities work or where the spaces are, but there are folks who are there to teach, who have had this calling and who want to give that energy and expend it on it. Also, pay people. Like, this is so much labor. Not only is it emotional labor, but it's like, it's heavy intellectual labor of preparing, of reading, of learning, of that whole life that has taken place for this person to be able to talk about these things. And paying them is so important because this is their life. Like, and this is how we, this, that's an aspect of decolonizing, is equivalent exchange, like creating that reciprocal relationship with somebody for their knowledge exchange. I know, like, in a lot of traditions in the North, people are given, in the North, where I come from, it's mostly tobacco that is exchanged for, like, knowledge, for prayers, but I've heard down here that it's also sage sometimes that is given, but different medicines are exchanged for that knowledge. And when you have the means to be able to give more than that, to give more than that, to recognize that, like, you are being in solidarity with that struggle.
Important words I hope all of our listeners will take to heart. I wish to extend my deepest gratitude to Kitsala Carson for sharing her knowledge and experience with us. For those who are interested in learning more about decolonization or connecting with Kitsala.
So my name's Kixala Carson, Q-U-E-T-Z-A-L-A-C-A-R-S-O-N. You can email me at kixala@ualberta.ca, Q-U-E-T-Z-A-L-A@ualberta.ca. I have a website called frizzlife.com, F-R-Y-Z-Z-L-Y-F-E. You can check out my writings and my music on there, and the Safe Stage, my label's music on there. Yeah, Twitter at frizzlife, Instagram at indigenouskilljoy. Yeah, I'd love to have conversations with people about this. So there's this piece that's really dense, but it's called Decolonization is Not a Metaphor. And it really picks apart movements to decolonize the academy and decolonize education and decolonize diets and decolonize all these things that are not the land. And it talks about how those movements can go towards the repatriation of land and law, and it talks about how they also are active erasers of that. So, decolonization is for everyone, but the co-optation of it by settlers, by folks of color, is something that takes away from the repatriation of land and law. So that, like, decolonization is not a metaphor is real good. I think it's by Kay Yang. It's by Yang and Tuck. Those are the last names of the authors. My favorite piece in the whole world is Postcolonial Peace by Brendan Hukuwitu and Tiffany Page. It's really heavy and really hard to read, and it talks about how peace doesn't exist on stolen land so eloquently and so beautifully. I really recommend that one. I come back to it every couple months just to ground myself. There's also a book by Glenn Coulthard called Red Faces, White Masks. Also, like, Black Faces, White Masks, like, oh my god, by Frantz Fanon. Like, get in that. Like, that'll break your heart. And another favorite of mine is Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. And all of these books are, like, and all of these readings are really theoretically dense, but if you have the examples to tie to them, they're a lot easier to understand, I find. So I really recommend that people do these things as communities, that people work together and, like, work through these dense materials as communities, and settlers get together to talk about these things and learn from each other and learn from whatever examples they have, like, because something that is, like, confused, I think, in this movement for decolonization, or at least I found in my classes, is that settler folks aren't recognizing that, like, all their knowledge is valid and all their knowledge is necessary for this movement to go forward. Mm-hmm. Like, we need these relationships. We need every part of who we are needs to be in that fight for decolonization. And every part of who we are, like, recognizing how sacred we are and how sacred everything is around us, is a part of that fight for decolonization. So not being afraid to jump in if you don't know, not being afraid to, like, learn more if you don't know, not being afraid to apply your experiences to what you're learning.
And we'll pick up this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
You can support Move to Amend reports and other Move to Amend programs by joining our $28 for the 28th Amendment monthly sustainer campaign. Pledge $28 a month and help make the We the People Amendment our 28th Amendment to the Constitution. Visit movetoamend.org/donate to sign up.
Help raise awareness about the movement to amend the Constitution by hosting your own House Party for Democracy. Invite family, friends, and neighbors for a screening of our mini-documentary, Legalize Democracy. To find the film and learn how to get started with your house party, visit movetoamend.org/houseparties. That's one word, movetoamend.org/houseparties.
You are listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we connect the dots between the current issues of our time and the nature of corporate rule. Our next conversation will focus on resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline and how those of us on the outside can support the Standing Rock Water Protectors. Since April, the largest coalition of Indigenous First Nations have been camped out at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation to wage a life and death struggle against Fossil Fuel Corporation Energy Transfer Partners, inspiring a national movement of hundreds of thousands across the U.S. and around the world to stand in solidarity with the Standing Rock Water Protectors. Our next guest tonight is an activist and state coordinator and volunteer from the Lake County Green Party who spent several weeks in the Oshete-Sikoan camp at Standing Rock and was also present on the night of November 20th when militarized police led by the Morton County Sheriff's Department used tear gas, concussion grenades, rubber bullets, and water cannons against the water protectors during a prayer ceremony in below freezing temperatures. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you so much, Laura. Thank you for having me.
Right.
I traveled with a group of folks from Lake County. I'm actually from north of that. I'm from Chico, California. I'm in Butte County, but I was able to travel with a caravan of folks from Lake County out to, it was about a 3-day drive out to Standing Rock. And I spent pretty close to, I kind of lost track of time out there, but, you know, several weeks. And it was a very, you know, it was a learning experience like none other.
Why did you decide to go to Standing Rock?
Well,
what was
mom,
it about Standing Rock that wanted you to, made you want to be there?
My mom's Kashaya Pomo from over here on the coastline in Northern California. For me, I've been watching on the internet, and it was pretty much, you know, I've been watching, interested to see what was happening, but then it was when the DAPL security hired out-of-town, you know, security people with, and they had these guard dogs that weren't registered to be guard dogs in North Dakota, and they had these untrained trainers, and they were sicking these dogs on the natives' horses and on the people. And, you know, Democracy Now! Luckily was there to capture that incident. where the dogs' faces were just covered in blood, and they were macing tons of people. And, you know, when I saw that, that's when I really, you know, I started helping to organize a bunch of No Dapple protests in Northern California, all over Northern California, Butte County, Nevada County, Sacramento County. And, you know, so it was kind of the culmination of seeing hundreds of tribes come together, even tribes that, you know, have been warring for, you know, hundreds of years, seeing them come together over it and seeing peace treaties being made between warring tribes, and seeing the support that was coming out was really, you know, the big motivator. It's obviously a historical event that hasn't happened since, you know, the greasy grass, and, you know, that's like 250 plus years ago.
One of the things that has really impressed me about this whole thing is that coalescence of tribes. I mean, just hundreds of tribes, apparently, and they're all from all over the Americas, including South America and, you know, Canada and in between. And so is that, has there ever been a meeting of that magnitude, you know, that stretched the breadth of the Americas that we're aware of?
Not internationally like that.
And so it's really an amazing thing.
It's just, yeah, it's something that's never, ever happened like before, you know?
Yeah. Okay. And so, just wanted to draw a line under that. I mean, this really is a huge historical event unfolding, and it's like not getting any press coverage.
Pretty shocking to see, you know, when you're out there in Standing Rock, you know, you get no cell phone service. You get no, you know, you're lucky if you can log on to Facebook up at their face. They called it Facebook Hill, you know. The tallest hill there in camp, and if you were lucky, you might be able to get a post out or something, you know. So, like, we didn't really know what was going on in the media. We were hearing things, but you pretty much had to travel about 10 miles back onto the reservation to get to the casino if you wanted to actually get any real, you know, see what was going on in the media. So we were kind of in this dead zone out there. It was just amazing to see when I finally did get to see what the media was saying, the 180 degrees from the truth that they were putting out there. You know, especially the day after November 20th, it was like Morton County police trying to say they didn't use water cannons, right? And then they had to backtrack on that statement because all the video came out of, you know, people being sprayed for hours and hours and hours with these water cannons. And they tried to say they didn't use tear gas or those horrifying concussion grenades, you know? And then they had to backtrack on that because the videos came out, concussion grenades going off all over the place. And obviously what happened to Sophie Walansky. There's my friend Efren from the Youth Council. There's this International Indigenous Youth Council there at Standing Rock. He got hit in the chest with a concussion grenade and it gave him a seizure. There's also Vanessa Dundon, who got hit in the face with a tear gas canister and it detached her retina. She's permanently blind for life, and she's got four kids. You know, those rubber bullets. So I was out there all night until it was all over, to about 5 a.m, where they ran out of water, they ran out of tear gas, and basically just broke their spirit, you know? Stayed out there singing, and I had my megaphone. And, you know, we were out there, you know, on the megaphone, our Indigenous brothers and sisters singing over the megaphone and trying to talk these cops down the whole entire time. Please cease fire, quit shooting rubber bullets, quit shooting these concussion grenades, quit spraying us. It was a long night, 167 cases of hypothermia and 300 injuries from those rubber bullets and concussion grenades, tear gas, and 27 trips to the emergency room for people like Sophie and Vanessa. We could actually, we called her Susie, right? And Efren, obviously, with the seizure, you know, there's 27 emergency room trips. And, you know, it was a really, really, really horrifying experience. And, you know, I'm doing okay with it right now, but I want to be honest with you guys that, you know, I've had a really, really hard time since I've been home. Like, I've never been in anything like that. I've never watched you know, people get hurt like that. I certainly never seen some girl get her arm blown off or anything like that. So it's been kind of hard. I had a hard time sleeping. Everybody, when you come back from Standing Rock, everybody's sick. I've never been that sick in my life. You know, I'm from California, right? Even the Standing Rock Sioux are making fun of us Californians out there. You know, they're just like, "Oh, you guys are from California. You guys ever seen your breath before?" They were good.
Oh, totally. I remember that, some of those quips or whatnot from staying at the California Kitchen Camp. You know, it was surreal because I arrived after the attack on the Backwater Bridge, and seeing the different portrayals within the media, what they chose to focus on, calling them protesters who were supposedly lighting fires, which the police were using the water cannons to put out the fires. And then in direct contrast with a bunch of these videos coming directly from camp that show there were no fires other than the ones that were caused by the concussion grenades, which they outright denied within the media. It's a war zone to a certain extent.
Did either of you encounter, did they have at the camp any kind of counseling for, you know, how enduring the resistance? I mean, it's
absolutely. So the Lakota talk about, you know, the concept of having emotional wellness. Basically, it's like human beings, you know, like whatever's going on inside you. If you got a bunch of messed up stuff going on inside you, no matter how much good you want to do, or no matter how much right you want to do, or how much you want to help somebody, if you got a bunch of messed up stuff going on inside you, that's just going to get all over everybody. For instance, you know, the next day I had a really hard time because I was the only one with like a megaphone out there. And when they would shoot off the tear gas, I was lucky the medics gave me a gas mask. So every time they'd shoot off these canisters, I'd yell through the megaphone, "Gas, gas, everybody get your masks." And, you know, I'd maybe get a couple breaths of that gas, but I'd be able to get my mask on. And every time somebody got hit with one of these rubber bullets or got hit with a concussion grenade, it was like the bridge was packed. And we, you know, we had to rush these people off to the truck to get them to the medic tent. So it was, I was having to follow these people carrying out these wounded people and be like, you know, clear a hole, medic coming through. So everybody would get out of the way so they could get people to the medic. I just saw so much, like the guy who got shot in the back of the head with the rubber bullet and it just split his head wide open, you know, and it was just gushing blood. And I just never seen anything like that before. So like the next day I woke up and everybody that I came with from California left the next day to come back home. And I was supposed to come back home, but I couldn't bring myself to do it because of what just happened. And I found myself trying to get a cup of coffee at the Sacred Fire, and there wasn't any cups left. And I just broke down and just started bawling because I couldn't get a cup of coffee. And somebody brought me a cup of coffee, and they were like, "Hey, man, you need to go to this wellness tent." And, I mean, this is for anything. You know, they basically, because it's a giant ceremony, they don't want people walking around with all that messed up stuff inside of you. Because then you're just walking around camp, getting that all over everybody.
One of the things that struck me was by what you've said, Eric, is, you know, how horrifying it is. It's a war zone, basically. And how unprepared you were for it. Well, I think everybody there was, you know, actually unprepared for it. Nobody, including, you know, the indigenous peoples, you know, go around beating up on each other with tear gas, rubber bullets, and concussion grenades, and dogs, and choppers. Yeah. And it really is a shared experience, I think, for so many people. You have the good privilege to be able to escape. Others, you know, it's not much of an escape to just retreat back over, you know, onto the reservation. Yeah. Land is not escaping. It's, you're still there on the front line. So it's really interesting to hear about the wellness tent, because I mean, I would imagine it's very hard to keep your spirits up and your determination intact under these conditions.
Yeah, well, it was packed the next day, you know. And, you know, one of the things you just said there is, like, one of the things I've really been grappling with is that, you know, I can come home, you know. I can come home to super, super safe Northern California where people, like, wave you in on traffic and stuff. I can do that. But for the Standing Rock Sioux, you know, if they want to go home, they're right where they're at.
Right. Yeah, like exactly.
I'm just so safe here, and there's like a little bit of guilt that I've been grappling with, you know, just not having to worry. I don't have to worry. You know, I'll never be cold in California ever again.
Well, that's true. And I think for many activists, that becomes part of the burden for many organizers and activists. Is part of the burden is when you're working on social justice issues that, and you see all the injustice and the pain and hurt and harm that it causes, how do you, you know, and the privilege that you have, it can be very, a deep hole of guilt that a person can sink into. And, you know, the important thing is to remember to recognize that you have privilege and then to use that privilege to assist others in their struggle.
Yeah.
That's all you can do.
The same thing was happening to the elders. Like hundreds of people got really, really, really injured there, you know. A couple days after that, we had an action at their sacred site, which is the Turtle Island. And we had enough people that we could have just took that sacred site back. But the elders said no. There was a lot of controversy about, you know, why didn't we take the hill? I can't speak for them. But my assumption is that so many people got injured that they were just like, we're not going to try and take this hill because we don't want a bunch of 21-year-olds with their arms getting blown off and mothers with their eyes put out and all this stuff. You know, even me, like when I was out there with the megaphone, you know, there's all these people with their lids from their totes that they, you know, probably brought their clothes in. And they were using these lids to block the water cannons and block the rubber bullets and so forth. And when I got out there with the megaphone and we were doing songs and chants and trying to talk these cops down, the cops started targeting me. And a bunch of people stood up in front of me with these lids, trying to keep the megaphone from getting wet and trying to keep me from getting shot with rubber bullets. And just like a lot of people, 700 people on that bridge, 300 of them got injuries and 167 of them got, you know, hypothermia. And I'm okay. I made it out okay somehow.
It's never easy to see or hear about people being hurt by the very people sworn to protect them, least of all over something as corrupt, over protecting corporate profits, over the needs and wants of the communities they serve. Fortunately, on December 4th, the Army Corps of Engineers did the right thing by denying the final permit to Energy Transfer Partners and announced it would conduct an environmental impact study, looking for alternative routes to the pipeline that don't go under a major water source, which is a major victory for the water protectors there. Unfortunately, the corporation immediately stated its intent to finish the pipeline without rerouting, and messages coming from the camp have been mixed between elders saying go home and youth leaders calling for folks to stay until the end. From your connections, Eric, do you know who is still at camp and who's continuing the fight?
This is something that most people don't know about Standing Rock. Initially, the tribal government sold out. They even asked for more money from the pipeline after the initial offer. And it was the youth. It was the youth that went out and started this whole thing and said, hey, no, we're not going to let you kill our water. You know, we're not going to let you poison our water. And then once the DAPL security started getting violent on them, that's when the adults showed up, started rearing up their horses at the police. And then that's when the dogs and the pepper spray incident started happening. And then that's when, you know, all the tribes started showing up. And then the next thing you know, it's Black Lives Matter and the clergy, and there's like Tibetans in camp. There's Palestinians in camp, you know what I mean? So now what's happened is seven council of elders, what I've heard from the Occupy camp, and it's, you know, it's all these minor independent parties and things. There's, you know, Green Party, Socialist Alternative, our Bernie-crats, Veterans for Peace, everybody's packing up, even Red Warrior. You know, this thing wouldn't be what it is if it wasn't for, like, Happy American Horse Jr. locking himself down on the equipment from Red Warrior, you know. And or even Red Warrior, if they haven't packed up yet and gone, they're on their way out. So right now, the only people that are left are 2,000, you know, like, vets and young folk that are able to tolerate this negative 9-degree weather. So they put out the Sacred Fire a few days ago. And it wasn't but like a day or two after that that the Chase ironized. And, you know, Chase has been there forever. And him and some of the elder females got together and said, hey, we're not leaving until the drill pad is gone. And so they started a new fire. They blessed it. And now there's a new Sacred Fire. And basically Chase Iron Eyes is the elder there now. So, you know, now the name of the camp was Machete Scully. And now now that there's a new Sacred Fire, it's Machete Awate, which means the people's camp. And so there's a new fire there now, and they're not leaving. They're not going to leave until that drill pad is gone.
We've heard about the support for this resistance, you know, from nations like Guatemala to organizations like Black Lives Matter. And it's, as I said before, absolutely amazing to see such an outpouring of solidarity nationally and internationally. But the fight still continues until the Black Snake is dead. How can our listeners at home support the Water Protectors in the coming year?
Okay, so right now, there was a fella in camp from Ohio. His name's Adam Elfers, and they put together defunddapple.org. In the last 2 weeks, they've managed to pull $18 million out of the banks that are funding this pipeline. You know, hashtag bank exit, right? You know, go to defunddapple.org. They have a letter that you can hand to your bank manager. They recommend that you put your money into a credit union or something local. Basically, you know, those big banks, you should see the spider web of banks. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's really the big guys, starting with Wells Fargo.
And that's defunddapple.org.
Correct. So right now we already got $18 million pulled out of all these banks, which are Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs.
Hey, those are the same banks behind the economic crash.
Correct. And also it happens to be 5 out of Hillary Clinton's top 10 donors. And we wonder why we never heard her say anything about Dapple, right? And it's not like Trump's any, you know, he's got $2 million invested in the energy transfer partners. So no matter if we went blue or we went red this year, we were going to get the pipeline, you know? So, yep. And that's what a lot of this Occupy inauguration thing is all about. Like, it kind of sounds like it's going to be a big Trump hate fest, you know? But what it is, you know, Trump is not the problem. Trump is a symptom of the problem. And the problem is the system, right? And the system is a two-party system that is owned by all the same banks we just mentioned. They got money invested in the Republicans. They got money invested in the Democrats, right? And, you know, as long as that system persists, that corporate system, we will never, ever get social justice or environmental justice. You know, you have to have economic justice. Because when people, you know, right now 60% of all income goes to the top 1%. That means that 99% of people are fighting over the 40% that's left over. You know, when people are fighting over jobs like, you know, dogs over scraps of food that are starving, it makes it really easy to draw a line in the sand and say, oh, it's a Mexican's fault. Or, oh, it's, you know, the Muslim's fault. When the truth of the matter, it's the corporate outsourcing. You know, the best economic period for the middle class in this country was the 1950s, and Eisenhower had a 92% corporate tax rate on the top 1%, right? Right now they're only paying 39%, right? So they've managed to whittle it down over the years. You know, Bernie Sanders was only talking about bringing it up to 52%, not 92% like Eisenhower had, but 52%. And when you're talking about the 1%, just that 20% hike is so much money that there's your college education for everybody and there's your healthcare. You know what I mean? So it's what it's going to take. And everything that us Bernie Sanders people learned for sure this year is that you have to have a party that's not tied to the economic elite in this country. That's what Occupy Inauguration is really about. It's not about just coming in and saying F Trump or whatever. It's about coming in and saying, look at the voter registration statistics. 26% of people are Republicans, 30% of people are Democrats, and 43% of people are independents, part of these minor parties, the Greens, Socialist Alternative. You know, keep your values, keep your stuff. We have so much in common, but we need to come together and unify because we are the majority, and then we can actually kick the corporations out of power.
Well said, Eric. As much as I'd like to continue this conversation for the next hour, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. So, Eric, what final comments would you like to leave with our listeners? And please, let folks know how they can continue to support the people at Standing Rock.
This is a thing you guys can do at home to help out. There's this girl named Red Fawn Fallis who is facing 20 years for attempted murder. She was a medic. She's an environmental, you know, she's been working for environmental justice her whole life. She worked with AIM, you know, the American Indian Movement. And, you know, like on October 27th, they raided, like, before they put up that razor wire wall on the bridge, at Backwater Bridge, there was a camp on the other side of it called 1851 Treaty Camp. And they raided that on October 27th. And on that day, Red Fawn was working as a medic, you know, washing people's eyes out from the pepper spray. And like eight cops tackled her and were doing her, you know, from what I saw in the video, you know, she's a little woman. How hard is it to arrest somebody that size? They were just beating the crap out of her. And one cop got his rubber bullet gun caught underneath her. And he fired off his rubber bullet gun three times, you know, for whatever reason. And you can see on the video the puffs of dirt coming out from underneath her. And they tried to say that she had a weapon, a woman that doesn't hunt, has never owned a gun in her life, and isn't working for environmental justice. They tried to say she had a weapon and tried to shoot the cops, you know, three shots. She's facing 20 years for attempted murder. She's a political prisoner. That's what she is. So what you guys can do at home is www.freeredfawn.com. If you could go there and, you know, help her out and help her family out. Her sister, Red Dawn Foster, is trying to get her out. So freeredfawn.com. Her name's Red Fawn Fallis. If you guys could help out with that, that'd be amazing. And this International Indigenous Youth Council, those are like all of her best friends, right? This is what most people don't know about Standing Rock, is it's the youth. It's this youth council. They're putting together all the actions. They were the ones putting everything together. And then the adults and all the seven council elders are just supporting them. But it's this little group of 20-year-olds that were like directing the whole thing, you know? And a lot of people have no idea that that's the case. And, you know, as a millennial myself, you know, I am amazingly impressed with their ability to do what they've done, you know? And so that's another thing. If you guys can go on Facebook or whatever, go to International Indigenous Youth Council, you know, help them out with their GoFundMe or whatever it is you can do for them. You know, there's some future leaders there that are going to be, you know, coming out after all this is said and done. And they could use your help getting their sister Red Fawn out of jail, you know?
Definitely. Thank you. Coming from this millennial, I'm looking forward to those future leaders really rising up and changing the world and really taking it back for we the people.
Yes.
So thank you so much, Eric. It was great talking with you about this. I'm sure our listeners will definitely appreciate and hopefully they'll get in touch and we can grow this movement.
Sounds great, man. That's what needs to happen.
And I also want to thank you for the time you spent with us tonight. It was incredibly interesting to hear about our takeaways from Standing Rock, and thanks a lot, Eric.
You're welcome, guys. Anytime you ever need anything, you just let me know, okay?
Are you part of a faith or ethical community whose values and principles are being violated by corporate actions? We, the people of the Move to Amend Interfaith Caucus, share in common a variety of values and principles. In this unity, we find the short-sighted and single-minded drive for profits by certain corporations has led to the degradation of the environment and our society. Corporate power has come to dominate our existence, with the values and principles we all hold dear being routinely violated by powerful corporations using their so-called personhood to influence elections, legislation, regulations, and judicial outcomes in their favor and at our expense. It is the purpose of the Interfaith Caucus to engage faith and ethical communities and educate about how the work of ending corporate rule can be approached from a spiritual, ethical, or religious perspective. Working together at national, state, local, and faith community levels, we can pass the We the People Amendment. Join us on our monthly calls the third Wednesday of each month at 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit movetoamend.org/interfaith-caucus for more information.
That is it for Move to Amend reports in 2016. We've been incredibly honored by the many activists and organizers who have shared their analysis and experience of current events and doing the tremendous work on the front lines of struggle against corporate rule to make the world a better place for all people, not just corporate and wealthy interests. We extend our heartfelt thanks to every one of them. This show has evolved in many ways since first airing in 2012, and we couldn't have achieved this success without the dedication and talent of our hosts Laura Bonham and Egberto Willis, the Media and Communications Committee helping to produce this show, and of course all of Move to Amend staff and affiliates doing the grassroots work to amend the Constitution. We want to lift up and thank every one of them for their great work, and most importantly, we want to thank you, the listener, for staying tuned for all these years. From now until January 26, we'll be on hiatus in order to fine-tune and reformat the show to better serve our work to end corporate personhood and get money out of politics. We'll return with a new monthly format that will feature more news and analysis from Move to Amend's national team and affiliates, offer more voices from a diverse backgrounds and perspectives on each show, and provide a wider range of analysis on the intersectional issues related to the nature of corporate rule and participatory democracy. Thank you so much for listening, and we wish you a happy holidays and a happy new year. See you in 2017.
Move to Amend Reports was created and brought to you by Move to Amend. Produced by national team members Keon Bliss, Laura Bonham, Egberto Willis, and Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, with the assistance of Renee Babcock, and with contributions from Move to Amend staff and affiliates. Opening theme entitled Move to Amend, performed by Shimako Noble and produced by Soul Circuitry.